everyone. Welcome back to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, the editor of Turbo Machinery International. And today we welcome back the Mythbusters, Klaus Brunn and Rainer Kurtz, to discuss a topic that, to be honest, that I'm unfamiliar with, which is turbo machinery codes and standards. But thankfully, the Mythbusters are familiar with them. So they're going to differentiate the two, go over some of the reasoning behind why they are used, what to do if an operator or a manufacturer disagrees with a standard, and more. So welcome, Klaus and Rainer, and thank you for hopping on the show today.
Well, thank you, Alyssa. Thanks for having me, and looking forward to this discussion today. And this, what I would consider to be a very, very relevant topic for turbo machinery, since many decisions in our industry are made based on codes and standards and guidelines and specifications. And so I think we will try to thoroughly discuss that today.
Yeah, same here. Thanks for having me. Again, as turbo machinery engineers, we spend an insane amount of time discussing and arguing about codes and standards. So the topic is very relevant.
Excellent. I'm excited to get started. So why don't you guys just kick us off with the differences between a code and a standard, you know, when to use and apply them, and then what are the most relevant standards that are current today being used for turbo machinery?
So let me kind of go off on this a little bit. There's really four things, and you can kind of order them by sort of importance. There are standards, codes, specifications, and guidelines. And really, a standard is somewhat of a generic the requirement. You can almost call it a minimum requirement that industry associations agree on that a piece of equipment should meet. And when I say these things, there's a lot of gray area in between here, but that's kind of sort of a big picture. And then there is specifications. Specifications are often related to a customer. So one of the major oil company may have its own specification, and they tie in standards very often. So let's say a Shell or a Chevron or whatever company they may have in their turbo machinery specification, they may refer to standards such as API 616, 617, 614, ASME standards, material standards, et cetera. And then you get into things like codes, and that becomes where the gray area is even bigger. But codes traditionally refer to something that's a little stricter. These are kind of like test codes where here is a process you have to follow and don't deviate from this process. Or there are even codes related sometimes to some OSHA requirements or to some legal requirements. So codes tend to be traditionally a little more rigid and a little more relevant and more rigidly followed. And then finally, we have industry guidelines, and those exist both from API, American Petroleum Institute, but also from other professional societies. And they kind of help to give advice and guidance on what should be done for a turbo machine, for a certain testing process, for design, et cetera. So these are kind of the four different levels. For turbo machinery, it's like with any codes and standards, there is, you can say tens, there's 100, or maybe there is 1,000. It depends on how you look at it. So let's say, for example, for gas turbines, there is API 616. So that's kind of one of the most relevant one. That is a product-specific standard. And then API 616 references in itself a number of other standards, and they are either subcomponents or materials or testing whatever type standard. So API 660 may reference 614, 610, 670, which are, for example, machinery protection, lube oil systems, etc. So usually subcomponents. And then these standards themselves, they will reference another 100 or so kind of standards. And so it easily gets out of hand, and there's an infinite amount of standards that you can look up, and obviously nobody has the time to read any of this kind of stuff. So one usually draws a circle around, you know, what are your key components if you're a generalist? And then if you are a specialist, let's say you're a materials engineer, then you focus on the ones that are related to materials. Or if you're a test engineer, then you focus on the ones that are related to testing. So that's kind of an overview of turbo machinery codes and standards. The most relevant ones are for turbo machinery API ones currently. There are some similar ISO standards, API 616 for gas turbines, API 617 for compressor, API 612 for steam turbines. And I'm probably missing a couple of other ones, but those are kind of sort of the ones where that are good starting points.
A couple of other things. I mean, the American Petroleum Institute has really generated a lot of these standards that revolve around turbo machinery, but the API is an American organization. So there's also the ISO, so that creates international standards that also has created a whole series of relevant codes and standards that often actually use API standards as the basis, and then they make modifications here or there. And then it depends a bit on the industry whether the ISO specification, the ISO standards are more dominant than the API standards. In oil and gas, it tends to be API. In some of the process industries, it's sometimes ISO. And again, that really adds to the confusion.
Yeah, and just to further confuse things, then you also have national standards, right? You have the Japanese specific standards and then the Japanese Society of Engineering, JSE standards. You have German standards, you have French standards, you have British standards. And so at the end of the day, everybody's utterly confused, and you have a couple of million pages of standards. But the good thing here is that most engineers that have been in the industry for a while, they kind of agree on what's relevant and what's not relevant. Because if you were to draw in all these standards and insist on all of these standards for every product, for a compressor, let's say you insist every standard that is referenced must be fully complied with and fulfilled, you would never ever have a compressor built or designed or anything, because it's nearly impossible, if not contradictory at times, between these standards. So the good thing is that most turbo machinery industry and engineers in the world actually know what's meaningful and what's not meaningful. I'm probably a little optimistic here.
Let's be very clear. A code or a standard is not a law. So there are laws and regulations. If you don't meet them, you're not allowed to operate your machinery in a country or in a certain industry. Okay? A code or a standard is not a law. And we'll probably talk more about that when we get further along.
Codes, you can look at them as purchasing specifications. You can look at a way of developing a common language between engineers, so that they all kind of sort of know what they're talking about when you define an efficiency or a normal operating point or a maximum allowable operating speed. All these nice things are defined in a standard, and so that allows engineers to talk to each other. But as Rainer mentioned, no code or standard or specification, for that matter, should design a turbo machine, because those are still designed by the turbo machinery manufacturer.
And there's one other thing. I mean, if you look historically, a lot of these standards were created because people had problems with machines at a certain for certain applications. So then engineers would get together and say, okay, what do we have to do to avoid these problems? And of course, since it fixes certain problems, but then certain other problems came up, you all of a sudden has a system that inherently starts to create more and more paper as the time goes on.
Yeah, that's called standard and code inflation, and it happens really for two reasons. One is what Rainer just mentioned: is every time a machine failed somewhere in the field, then people learn from the failure. That's a good thing, right? But then usually, whatever is learned is then added in some form at some time into the code and standard, which then makes it more and more restrictive to be creative on a design, because you put a lot of rules and regulations into the design process. And that's why it's very important to understand that no turbo machine is designed by a code and a standard. And if a manufacturer does not want to adhere by a code and standard, then that manufacturer should explain why. And hopefully that's a good explanation that's related to safety, efficiency, performance, or something. And then the obviously purchaser or the operator of the equipment is still have the option to say, I don't accept that, I don't like it. Or you can say, yeah, that makes absolutely sense. But it is important then to have at least that open discussion in the process. The other reason that codes and standards are growing is because you have these committee meetings every couple of years where people get together, and nobody just wants to take a code, let's say like API 617, and say, hey, we're just going to leave everything the way it is. Everybody wants to add their own little thing. And so we've seen codes like, say, API 616, which grew from something like 30-something pages in the 1960s, late 60s, to what is now over 350 pages long, right? So it's gone excessive. And the reality of that is then nobody can read this stuff anymore. And even the manufacturers can't even keep up with that anymore, because every time a new code comes out, that kind of forces a manufacturer to read that thing and make sure that they have appropriate comments for that. And it's hard to keep up with some of these codes and standards.
Yeah, and what Klaus mentioned about sometimes hindering innovation, there are some very good examples for that. There are, for example, certain types of gearboxes that you cannot use in oil and gas applications, not because they don't work or because they're technically inferior, but simply because they're not part of a code. There were for many years restrictions on how you built the rotor of a compressor. That also was not really a technical problem, was just not in the code. And therefore, it was very difficult to use these type of designs. So a code is certainly a tool to avoid problems, but it often will make innovation very, very difficult.
Yeah. And one last code or value of a code and standard is that they do allow a purchaser to do a comparison when they get offers from various manufacturers on the product, and they want to have a fair comparison. At least it provides a baseline of discussion. And again, every manufacturer will take exceptions to certain items in the codes and standards, because some of them make sense, some of them don't make sense, some of them are very specific to a certain application that may not make sense in a different application. So you will have exceptions, and industry experience has shown that if purchasers and manufacturers are willing and open to discuss these, you end up with a better product.
Okay, so I'm going to tag another question onto the next question based on what you said. Definitely go over some of the benefits and some of the maybe challenges when relying on the standards. But you said that some of these are like 350 pages. So how does a manufacturer approach this? Like how does this work as far as if they're so comprehensive and long, how are they applied?
So very carefully, but it is an issue. And these are very relevant documents. If there is a new edition, let's say, of API 616 that comes out maybe every 5-7, worst case scenario, 10 years, everybody will review this very carefully. And there's many engineers in the manufacturing companies who will then carefully review this document and determine the impact of these codes and standards on their product. So these are very relevant. And when, you know, Reiner mentioned earlier that he's probably spent a significant amount of hours in his career on reviewing codes and standards, and so have I, there's a tremendous amount of money that is implicitly associated with the usage of codes and standards. So they provide a tremendous benefit in the sense of common language, purchasing specification, certainly a baseline for design. You can make sure that there is certain quality in the product. All of that's good, but there is a certain cost associated by following rigidly on codes and standard, and everybody needs to be aware of that.
Yeah, and it really goes both ways. I mean, first of all, reviewing these codes typically does not mean you throw 300 pages at a guy, and then after 2 months of work, he appears back from his office. Typically, the requirements of a code, in, like for example, API 617 or API 6 for gas compressors and 616 for gas turbines, usually involves many disciplines within the manufacturer. So you basically have multiple groups of people contributing to these reviews. So that's one thing. On the flip side, what you also do is you make sure that, for example, your design departments know about these codes and understand these codes, not necessarily as a you have to follow them, but certainly with regards to telling them that this is sort of the general industry expectation in designs.
Yeah. And when you talk 300 pages, it's really far, far more than that. Because let's say if you look at the gas turbine or a compressor, there's a lube oil system, right? And so then API 610 is the lube oil systems, I think. Or was it 614?
14.
14, sorry. Too many codes and standards. And so then there is a specialist engineer in a company that then will review that, the specification. And so there is 670, for example, which is machinery protection, kind of sort of control stuff and instrumentation stuff. So there'll be a specialty engineer who needs to review that. And so it's not just the first level product specific one, gas turbine, compressor, steam turbine, pump, et cetera. It's all the subcodes that go along with it. Usually you leave it at one subcode, but then, for example, when it comes to material certification testing, you have to get into ASTM standards, welding standards. You have to get into all these kind of things. ASME code 8 standard for integrity of structural components. So there's all kinds of standards. And yes, they are being very, very carefully reviewed in the industry, and significant discontent can occur if, for example, a product is sold as meeting a certain standard, and it turns out it doesn't meet that standard at a later date. That's certainly something where somebody could go to court with and sue a manufacturer for not meeting a contractual obligation, because these codes become part of the sales contract, including the exceptions, et cetera, that are part of the manufacturer's response.
And I just want to, because we talked about laws versus codes and standards, the standard in it by itself is not necessarily enforceable. And certain codes, for example, specifically say that these are not they don't infringe on promises and guarantees. What makes it enforceable is if a customer in the purchase specification says, thou shalt follow such and such API requirements or these ASME codes, and then it becomes part of the contract, and then it becomes enforceable.
Yeah. And so in our industry, we have really certain types of industries that very closely adhere to these standards. So for example, the refinery industry, which is obviously has to be very safety conscious, because any small accident can result in a multitude of other things exploding around you, right? When you have hydrocarbons in vessels under pressure, et cetera, that tends to be a little bit on the dangerous side. And so these types of industries where the risks are higher tend to be much more strict on the adherence to these codes than other industries. For example, in the power generation industry, we probably don't see quite as much adherence to codes and standards, because in most cases, when something fails, it will just call the shutdown of a plant and not necessarily anything beyond that. Whereas if you have a refinery and something fails, it could result in a system breakdown with very long shutdowns and safety issues associated. And so there's kind of sort of, in our industry, we see the refining and the petrochemical operators being very, very adherent to API or similar international standards. And then we see, for example, the midstream guys being less so, because they're transporting gas from, let's say, a pipeline. And the risk, yeah, there is risk associated with it, but it's less human risk than it is machinery risk. And then you sometimes see on the upstream operators, you see more adherence again, depending on which kind of application it is. But for example, in the gas plant, you see more adherence to that, similar to a refinery in a sense. But then in the field itself, it may not be. And it's really driven by risk, right? The more risk you have, the more risky the application is, the more you tend to be a little more careful following these standards and maybe willing to spend a little more money meeting a certain requirement, because you want to limit risk.
And you also have to acknowledge that there's another purpose of these codes and standards, and that's sort of in the field of system integration. I mean, if you build yourself a refinery, so there's one manufacturer who builds such and such compressor and the driver, and then there are people who build the pressure vessels, and then there are people who build the piping and maybe the steam turbines. So there are a lot of different parties involved that all have to come together. And one of the things that these codes and standard does is that there is a reasonable definition of the interfaces. Because at the end of the day, somebody needs to integrate all of that stuff. And certainly for that purpose, codes are very, and standards are very helpful.
This is especially true for things like material specifications,
yes,
welding specifications, test specifications for materials. Those kind of things are really relevant, because if you follow, you know, a material is ASTM something something, then you know it's that kind of material and it's compatible with this kind of coding. It's compatible with this kind of application. And then all the flange interfaces, they're defined and several standards are, you know, these are important when you put pipes together, that you know how to put them together. So the compatibility issue is very relevant. So that's a very good point. In that it also provides a common language, as I mentioned before. You have a common language now. If somebody talks about this gas turbine has an ISO power rating of something, then you know what the definition of ISO power is for a gas turbine. Similar, you know what a maximum allowable working pressure is, you know what a maximum allowable speed is, continuous operating speed. All of these things that we continuously, when we talk to each other in our industry, that we continuously use as a normal verbiage, is defined in these standards.
What if, you know, either the operator or the manufacturer disagrees with the standard? What happens then?
I mean, the best thing that can happen is that they have a discussion about it, and then sense prevails, right? If there's usually a right and a wrong, but they may not necessarily agree on what's right or wrong, and sometimes it's not quite that clear cut. In many cases, it then just becomes a question of money, right? If the customer, an operator, insists of, I want this piece of, let's say, lube oil tank made out of stainless steel, and the manufacturer says it's got to be carbon steel and it's painted, then okay, you can give them stainless steel. And there's benefits in having stainless steel. There's no question about it, but the question of money too.
In general, if you start with a certain code as a manufacturer, you have certain things that you can do that are just either inconvenient, take more time, or cost more money. There are things that are painful to do, but can be done. And there are things that simply a given design does not let you do. And so within that continuum, you will have a discussion. And it depends on who sits on the other side. I mean, most of the bigger customer have their own, either in-house or hire them, their turbo machinery experts that should be in a position to evaluate how detrimental a certain exception to a code is to the overall project, and who also should understand what drives necessary costs and what drives unnecessary costs. And then you have a discussion. And, you know, sometimes that discussion may lead to, okay, we're not going to buy from such and such manufacturers because they cannot do what we want. In many instances, however, it will be, okay, so there's a cost advantage. It does not impact our operation. And we go with what's offered. So it goes all over the place.
Some of these discussions about reviewing the, let's say, codes and standards for a project, you know, and their exceptions from the manufacturer, the comments to the exception, then the comments to the comments to the comments, and so on, it goes on. Those discussions can last months. They can even, I've seen them last years, because there may be disagreement, and some of these become very relevant issues. On the cost side, but also on the operability side, and as Rainer said, on the which manufacturer is qualified to provide a certain piece of equipment. And yes, if you design something to a certain design criteria, and then if one of the codes says you can't do that, you can't use this material, you can't use this manufacturing process, you can't use this testing process, then you can easily be disqualified in the process. And so that's something that at least one needs to know before one goes into the bidding phase of a project, also which codes are going to be rigidly enforced and which are not going to be rigidly enforced. It really comes down to risk and money in many of these discussions, but codes and standards are the subject to significant discussions and also to big problems when, for example, a customer misunderstood what something means, or a manufacturer misunderstood what something means, designed something, built something to something, and then later on it turns out, okay, we didn't meet this code and standard, or we thought it wasn't relevant, and suddenly you're facing a very unhappy customer, or vice versa. So these things are relevant. And I, when I talk to young turbo machinery engineers, I always make them read API 617 for compressors once. That used to be easy because, as I said, it was 60, 70, 80 pages. Now it's 170 pages, so nobody wants to read this stuff anymore. And I can assure you it makes you fall asleep after about half a page or so.
Yeah, that sounds so painful.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Is there anything else that you guys want to touch on that I didn't ask, you know, you guys didn't already mention?
Yeah. I mean, the only comment is that you have now seen over the last, I've been in this industry for 30 years. Rainer's been in this industry for 30 plus years. And we've seen this inflation, this growth of specifications. And sometimes, not just the customer, because customers realize it's okay, there's too much in it, we're going to have to cut this back. But even the industry associations that create these standards may sometimes need to step back and say, hey, we got too much here. And we have not seen that. I've not seen that yet. I would strongly encourage, for example, some of our industry committees, and I'm part of many of these industry committees, so I should look at myself for this, but would encourage us to step back and kind of start weeding out stuff that's really not relevant in existing codes rather than creating more and more and more codes.
Yeah, I can only second that. I'm not aware of any code that shrunk in size in the recent decade or so. So there is a bit of an inflation, and it is indeed, when you go to these committee meetings, it's very difficult to get rid of something. Because there's always, again, I mentioned that earlier, a lot of the requirements in these codes are because somewhere, sometimes in the past, something went wrong. So people said, okay, we're not going to let this happen again, so we write such and such requirement in there. That may mean that in the last 20 years, that was never a problem anymore. And maybe the original problem, if you were to look at it, was driven by totally different circumstances and was just a one-off problem. But there is practically no mechanism that really re-evaluates in codes what's necessary and what's not necessary.
Yeah, there probably needs to be a discussion. And we are a mature industry now. We're not a young and up-and-coming industry. We're a mature industry. So there's probably some need for discussion in our industry of curtailing and killing some of these things in our codes. But that's probably something that will require a lot more discussion before we get there.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much for breaking this down and coming on the show today. It was great talking to you.
Thanks. Enjoyed it. Looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely. This was a fun discussion. And you see, it was very heartfelt.
Because we all have done this in our career many, many times.
All right. Well, thank you guys again. And thank you to our audience for tuning in today. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, and we will see you next time.